Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
I welcome Professor H.W. Brands, Bill Brands. His new book, America First, Roosevelt versus Lindbergh in the Shadow of War. It is April 1939. A young man is exiting a transatlantic steamer, and he's greeted by what appear to be a football team of flashbulbs popping as he walks off. The police form a barrier for him to get off the ship. His name is Charles Lindbergh, Lucky Lindy, and he remarks in his diary, and I have this thanks to the professor, that the bulbs were popping so fast and they were smashing to the ground that it was like walking across glass. The excitement here is because of events in Europe and events in the United States that are about to lead to a huge controversy based on the understanding of not going to war again as we did in 1917, because the American people resented what they'd been told the war was for, the war to end all wars, the war to save democracy, and the results had been the usual colonial empires battling each other for regions and space and resources in Europe, while America went home in grief. Professor, congratulations. This is an incredibly rich story with all kinds of connections about America and its reluctance to get involved in European wars. Lindbergh, at this point, he's 37 years old, and he's world famous. Why? What is it that they're still celebrating about him 12 years after the Spirit of St. Louis flew the Atlantic in a solo flight? Good evening to you.
Well, thank you. So the reason that Lindbergh was famous in 1939 is precisely for what he did in 1927. The world had never heard of Charles Lindbergh until, out of the night, he landed his plane in Paris, and he had flown the Atlantic. This was the technological feat of the era. I liken it to the landing on the moon in the 1960s. And Lindbergh was to the 1920s and early 1930s what astronauts were in the 1960s and early 1970s. These were men who had technical proficiency. They were smart, obviously, but they were brave as well. And they had dared to do things that had never been done before. So when Lindbergh flew out of the night into Paris, and he was surrounded by floodlights and surrounded by people, he was immediately embraced by the French people. He was this hero. He was a world celebrity. He might very well have been the most famous American in the world as a result of this. And he had just the personality for it. He was not boastful. He seemed to be sort of modest and shy. He was well-spoken. Helped that he was good looking. He was the kind of young man that every mother and father would say, boy, we hope our sons grow up to be like that. And during the period from 1927, getting us up to 1939, he had remained in the spotlight, partly against his will. He married into a wealthy banking family with the House of Morgan. But the thing that really riveted the attention of the world was in the early 1930s, when his and his wife's infant son was kidnapped and murdered. And it seemed to be this horrible thing that had happened to this very admirable person. And it became the focus of attention. It was called the crime of the century, and it gave rise to the trial of the century. The fact that this was in the early days of movie newsreels was really important, because for the first time, people on movie screens, when they go to the movies on Saturday, they could see Lindbergh and see what he was doing in the courtroom. And we would call the people who followed him around, the photographers that you referred to, we might call them paparazzi today. But basically, these were people who wanted to get the photographs of this famous guy. Their pestering of Lindbergh became so annoying that he took his family and moved to England to get out of the spotlight. And the moment you refer to is when he's coming back, when he and his wife are, they're coming back in 1939, because it looks like Europe is about to go to war. And Lindbergh realizes that if there's a war on, he needs to be back in America.
The walking over of the broken bulbs immediately reminded me, and his diary is extremely well written, but he didn't connect it, so I'm going to connect it. Kristallnacht, November of 38. He was in Paris when Kristallnacht happened. He then was in Berlin trying to puzzle through what has happened to the German people who are so neat and so organized. He's been in England, but he's been studying the deterioration of conditions in Europe. What is his thinking as he arrives back in America? What does he make of what he left behind in Britain and in France and in Germany?
Lindbergh had a stubborn admiration for German culture. He thought the Germans knew how to do things right, and he was quite dismayed at this strange and alarming turn that German politics had taken. So he did not know what to make of Kristallnacht. He did not know what to make of Adolf Hitler. He did not know what to make of the rise of the Nazi Party and the apparent obvious embrace by the German people of these strange new movements. So this puzzled him. He was very discouraged about the British and Britain's approach to world affairs, because he thought Britain at one time had been a great country, but it had allowed itself to fall into complacency and apathy. And this seemed to be marked by the fact that the British and the French had established this post-war regime at the Paris Peace Conference of 1919. And they'd imposed these restrictions on Germany, which were unrealistic at the time, as almost everybody realized. And then they refused to enforce them afterwards. So it was as though the British thought that they could continue to cruise on the momentum that their empire had in the 19th century. But Lindbergh thought that Britain's day was behind it. Its great time was behind it. And this was why he was so puzzled at the policy of the British, that they made these demands of Germany. They said, you must do this. They made promises to Czechoslovakia, which they didn't follow through on, and then to Poland. And he was afraid that, okay, well, they're going to be called upon to fulfill the promise of the guarantee of security to Poland, but they're not going to be able to do it. And the result is that Hitler will call their bluff, and Europe will be at war. And the British, Lindbergh strongly suspected, they will look to the United States to bail them out the second time, the way the United States had bailed out the British in World War I.
Immediately, he's in Washington, beckoned to meet with the President of the United States after visiting with Hap Arnold, the head of the Army Air Corps, and also exchanging glances, I believe, with General Marshall and the Secretary of War, Mr. Woodring. But he's with the president, I believe, for the first time, because he notes in his diary, carefully written diary, wonderful to have this document, that he realizes the president is disabled, but cheerful and charming. Why does FDR want to see him so quickly? Why is FDR so charming and convincing? What does he want from him?
Lindbergh is still one of the most celebrated Americans. So he had a following simply because he was Charles Lindbergh. He also had great and detailed knowledge of the aircraft, especially the military aircraft of the world. He had helped design his own plane in flying across the Atlantic, and he had kept up on the state of aircraft technology. Whenever he would visit a foreign country, the people who made the airplanes, especially the Air Corps, the Air Forces, would invite him to come look at their planes. And they'd pick his brain and say, well, what can we do to improve them? And so he knew what the air fleet of France was like. He knew what the air fleet of Britain was like, that of Russia, of Germany, of Japan. And so, of course, the people in the War Department in Washington, they wanted to know what he knew. He wasn't an official air attaché, but he was, in effect, an unofficial air attaché. He still had a commission as a colonel in the Army Air Corps Reserve. And so he was essentially obliged to check in when he would come back. And so he goes to Washington to go to the War Department, and then he's invited to the White House. And Franklin Roosevelt wants to bring him in because Lindbergh's comments that Lindbergh had made to people like Joseph Kennedy in Britain, the American ambassador in Britain at the time, gave Roosevelt cause to believe that Lindbergh might be skeptical of American policy, especially as skeptical of what Lindbergh supposed would be pressure to diminish America's neutrality and take the side of Britain and France should a war break out. And Roosevelt wanted to essentially co-opt Lindbergh by bringing him into the administration, figuring that if he was inside the tent, he would be easier to control than if he were outside the tent. And Lindbergh realized this. He realized, in fact, in a short space of time, he finds Roosevelt charming in this meeting, but he realizes that this is a charm that Roosevelt can put on. And he talks about how he understands how Roosevelt can charm people. And there's part of Lindbergh that is refusing to be charmed. But in particular, he's refusing to accept the offer to come into the administration because Lindbergh was very jealous of his own independence, his ability to speak his mind without feeling obligated to anybody else. And this would be a characteristic of his position during this whole period. And so he declines to join the Roosevelt administration. He realizes that Roosevelt will be trying to move the United States toward, well, toward siding with Britain and France should a war break out. Lindbergh doesn't want to have any part of it.
The book is America First, Roosevelt versus Lindbergh in the Shadow of War. H.W. Brands, Professor Brands, the author. When we come back, war. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.
Hey guys, finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy, thanks to Goldbelly. Goldbelly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Goldbelly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.